This week, Donald Trump prepares for his presidency as world leaders look for what it could mean for U.S. foreign policy.
The dominant theme in my mind will be transactionalism and unilateralism.
And a look at what led to Trump's decisive election win.
When you look at some of the data about, like, you know, what kind of pushed Trump over the top, it was male voters and voters of color.
Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
Hello, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
From this day forward, it's going to be only America first.
That was from Donald Trump's first inaugural speech. His policy approach in world affairs is more isolationist diplomatically, non-interventionist militarily, and protectionist economically.
The U.S. is currently paying much more than any other nation, and that is not fair to the United States or the United States taxpayer.
Trump critics and supporters say America's place in world affairs and security will fundamentally change. Joining us now for some perspective on what those changes might look like is Charles Kupchan, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University.
So thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
So tell me, big picture, what we should expect from a Trump administration foreign policy.
The dominant theme in my mind will be transactionalism and unilateralism. And by that I mean that President Trump seems to be someone who operates less as a statesman and more as a real estate mogul. And he'll be out there trying to cut deals with foreign powers over trade, over Ukraine, over other key issues on the agenda. And I don't expect there to be the same investment in institutions, in pacts, in what we call multilateralism that we've seen during the Biden administration. And there is also, I think one can expect a certain amount of erraticism, inconstancy. Trump doesn't seem to have a clear kind of template or blueprint in mind when it comes to the guidance of American statecraft. And I think as we saw during the first term, his own team may be scrambling to figure out exactly what the president wants to do. He tends to govern through impulse more than through a sort of worked out policy process.
And, you know, he will be walking into a lot of very serious global crises, including the war in Ukraine and the situation in Gaza. What do you see potentially changing in regard to the U.S. role in both of those?
Well, it's a very good point, because during Trump's first term, there was, you know, relative geopolitical quiet. And that's not the case today. I think it's unquestionable that Trump will early on in his presidency seek to bring an end to the conflict in Ukraine and to push both Russia and Ukraine to the negotiating table to the end of reaching a ceasefire. I don't think that we can hold out hope for some sort of durable peace settlement with a consensus about what happens to those parts of Ukraine still occupied by Russia. But I do think there's at least a chance that Trump can bring the parties to de-escalate the conflict and maybe to agree to stop the fighting at least for now. I think in the Middle East, in some ways, we may see the opposite. We may see Mr. Trump encourage Netanyahu to get it over with. That is, to increase the pace of the conflict against what we call the axis of resistance, not as Biden has doing, encouraged the Israeli government, the prime minister, Mr. Netanyahu, to look for a ceasefire. After that, I do think Trump will push for some sort of post-war deal, some blueprint that a new Middle East could get behind. But I think his emphasis in terms of Ukraine will be to stop the war. His emphasis in terms of Israel will be to hurry up and finish the war.
What do you sense the U.S. overall role in the world is going to be? Do you think it's still going to be? He was not, you know, really keen on being leader of the free world in his first term. Do you see a change in that regard?
You know, I do see a change. I think that Trump breaks the mold formed after World War II. And it's really during World War II and the Cold War that a certain template emerged of a world anchored by American power and American values, what we call the rules-based liberal international order. And I don't think that Trump has that kind of ideological ambition. I don't think he sees the United States as the world's policeman, nor does he see a world in which everybody needs to aspire to be a liberal Democrat. He doesn't want to go out and change the world in America's image in the same way that I think you've seen many, many American presidents since World War II do. And in that respect, he'll be more of a pragmatist, of a deal maker. And I think that there's some value to that in the sense that, you know, President Biden portrayed this century as defined by a clash between democracy and autocracy, very ideological take on what the world looks like today. And I think Trump will say, you know what, I'll work with anybody who will work with me. And that's, I think, an advantage because we now live in a world that is becoming very much ideologically diverse, in which power is diffusing from north to south and from west to east. And the kind of ability of the United States to be the world's policeman and to push out its values is becoming harder over time. And so it may be that if Trump can cut deals, not just with democracies, but with non-democracies like China, we may make progress toward the kind of collective initiative across ideological dividing lines, across geopolitical dividing lines, that may be necessary to tame this globalized world that we live in.
What about NATO? Trump has in the past talked about removing the U.S., pulling out of NATO. How would that impact the country and our allies, and will the sort of base of our allies, will that shift?
Well, you know, right now I would say there is enormous nervousness and anxiety on the other side of the Atlantic, precisely because nobody knows whether the United States is going to remain a European power, to stay in Europe as NATO's leading country and as the country that has been backing Ukraine since the full-scale Russian invasion in 2022. I don't expect Trump to withdraw from NATO. He's mused about it. He has said, if you don't spend enough on defense, I'm not going to defend you. But I think you have to say, does Trump want to be remembered as the president who dismantled the Western alliance? Does Trump want to be remembered as the president who lost Ukraine? I think the answer is no. And so I do believe he'll try to broker a peace in Ukraine. I think he will push European allies to spend more on defense so that the United States has a better partner on the other side of the Atlantic. but I don't expect him to withdraw from NATO. And that's in part because Russia has invaded Ukraine. Russia continues to pose a threat to NATO territory. NATO has let in Sweden and Finland. Finland has a long, long border with Russia. And I think that the troops that have gone to Europe in the aftermath of Russia's attempt to subjugate Ukraine, they are now part of a new effort to fortify NATO's eastern flank. I don't see them coming home anytime soon. I see Trump pushing, as I said, NATO allies to shoulder a fairer share of the defense burden. I'd be very surprised if he basically attempts to pull down the whole edifice.
You talked a little bit about a sort of realignment of philosophy globally, and you see the loose coalition between China, Russia, North Korea, the Global South, BRICS. How do you think we play into that in terms of what you said before?
Well, the world of the 21st century is going to be very different than the world that we've been living in for the last, really for the last couple hundred of years, in the sense that it was over the course of the 18th century into the 19th century that the West pulled ahead of the rest. Power shifted from the South and the East to the North and to the West. And first Europe and then Europe alongside the United States have been at the vanguard of history ever since. They have enjoyed material and ideological prominence, dominance even. You know, if you look at where we will be in 2050, where we'll be in 2060, projections suggest that the world's leading economic power will be China. Number two will be India. Number three will be the United States. Number four will be Indonesia. And our traditional allies, like Japan and Germany and France, they will fall way down the ranking. In other words, we're going to be living in a world in which power diffuses from center to the periphery, in which the West hopefully will remain a political community anchored by liberal democracy, but we're going to be living in a much more ideologically diverse and politically pluralistic world. And I think one of the key challenges for Mr. Trump and for those who come after him is how do we get there? How do we tame a world in which the emergence of multiple centers of power, the emergence of a more ideologically diverse international system, how do we get there peacefully? I don't think we've started to answer that question, quite honestly. I'm not sure that President Trump will have a kind of big picture answer, but I'm hopeful that because he's transactional, because he's willing to go out there and attempt to broker deals with democracies and non-democracies alike, we may be able to make at least some progress in that general direction.
Charles, thanks so much for the time and the insight.
Happy to be with you. Thank you.
That was Charles Kupchan, Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Scott Walterman with Lori London.
For over 200 years, America has carried on the greatest experiment in self-government in the history of the world. And that's not hyperbole, that's a fact. We're the people. The people vote and choose their own leaders, and they do it peacefully. And we're in a democracy. The will of the people always prevails.
U.S. President Joe Biden at the White House on Thursday addressing the American people.
Yesterday, I spoke with President-elect Trump to congratulate him on his victory. And I assured him that I'd direct my entire administration to work with his team to ensure a peaceful and orderly transition.
As preparations for the transition to the Trump administration get underway, people are still trying to understand how Trump won so decisively.
When you look at some of the data about, like, you know, what kind of pushed Trump over the top, it was male voters and voters of color.
According to an Associated Press survey, Trump held his core base of voters and slightly expanded his coalition to include several groups that have traditionally been a part of the Democratic base.
An unprecedented number of Republicans endorsed Democrat Kamala Harris. Among them, former Republican New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman, who served also as the head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency under Republican President George W. Bush. She is now a member of the centrist Forward Party. She joined in 2022. She joins us now to unpack why so many voters went for Trump.
Thank you, Governor Whitman. We appreciate your taking the time to speak with us. Were you somewhat surprised at the results?
I think I'm as surprised as anyone at the magnitude of the win and the sweep that the Republicans have had.
What do you think happened if you were going to do a postmortem on the election?
Well, I think Democrats had been for too long believing their own press. I mean, the economy is doing well. If you are in the stocks, if you are of higher income, but when you have to worry about whether you're going to be able to pay your bills, your mortgage, and or whether you eat, or whether you have to work two jobs, then it's not working well. That doesn't play with the person who is struggling, and there are a lot of people who are struggling, and at least Donald Trump, I mean, he lies, and he doesn't really care about the little person, but he talked to them. He said to them, I hear you. He said, I'm going to make it better, and they were looking around, and the Democrats, unfortunately, were not responding to that. And the same thing, the seriousness of the immigration crisis. It took too long for Kamala Harris to actually say, we're going to get really, you know, tougher. This is how I'm going to differ. And she was in a very difficult position, of course, because she didn't have much time to pull together a campaign. Joe Biden was not a popular president, even though I think he did some very good things. It was, again, the James Carville's famous line, it's that the economy, stupid. And that's what was pulling everybody down. So she had to overcome that at the same time, because she was a part of it and respectful and there were good things that were done. She couldn't divide herself from it too much. She couldn't distance herself too much. And so that put her in a tough bind. And it's really hard when you have someone who will literally say anything and promise anything and say how terrible the world is, that all the immigrants who are coming in are all rapists and drug dealers. I mean, just blatant, flat-out lies, but you say it enough, and that's the essence of advertising. You keep saying it over and over again, and people will believe it, or people would want it. And so people believed it. And in the border states, they were being overwhelmed. Yes, the last month was the lowest border crossing, I think, in years. That may be an exaggeration, but certainly much lower than any year of Trump. So it's coming under control, but still it became an issue in the Northeast when you had governors from the Southwest who shipped illegal immigrants up to the bigger cities. And, you know, there wasn't a recognition that this poses a real problem. It's not that they're all going to commit crimes. It's that they take space and you don't have housing for them. They do not take jobs from, it's interesting, I think that one of the things we take away from the Hispanic community is they were convinced that the illegals coming in, the Spanish language immigrants coming in, were going to take their jobs. That wasn't the case. Most of them that came in and were able to find jobs were taking jobs that no American wanted. And they were probably undermining the financial structure in the area because they worked for less than many, not in every case, but in some cases. I mean, they just never acknowledged all those subtleties of these big issues and didn't, and the Democrats I'm talking about. And when you have someone who's going to inflate them all, make them seem much worse than they are, you listen to him because he's echoing what you think, and then he's validating, unfortunately, ways of acting out on that. And I hate to say it, but I think also racism and misogyny played into it. There were a lot of people who just could not see a woman, particularly a black woman, in the presidency. And that's shame on all of us, or shame on all those who felt that way. But it was that definitely played a role.
If you look at the data, you see this, he peeled off not just working class whites, but working class Latinos,
right,
working class Black, working class women. Is there a realignment happening? Because did you see the comments from Bernie Sanders, who said he was not surprised by the outcome of the election because the Democratic Party is not talking to the working class anymore?
Well, that's true. They're not. They missed that entirely. I'm not sure the Bernie Sanders solutions are going to be the ones, but the Democratic Party has to find out what it is and who it is. And I think a lot of the people who voted, who had been Democrats, who voted Republican, they felt that just as a lot of the Republicans who voted for Kamala felt the Republican Party had left them, there are a lot of Democrats who think the Democratic Party is moving too far to the left. Kamala ran very much to the left 4 years ago, and she has changed. And that's okay if someone will stand up and say, look, I've learned things. And when I learn things, I'm willing to change if I think I should. What do you do when you find out new facts that are contrary to what you knew before? If she'd said something like that, I think people would have become more comfortable, because she was running very much from the center in this election, mm-hmm, in an upbeat election. But I think people just didn't trust, and they were able to put up, the Trump people were able to put up those ads at the very end, talking about how she, was way out in left field. And that scared a lot of people.
It's interesting, though, because the coalition that she had, we're talking Dick Cheney and Bernie Sanders, Liz Cheney, and all these unprecedented number of Republicans, which was sort of stunning, and that were crossing over, including, many in his former team, including, the military leaders.
Danger, right.
Right. And so
I talked to a person at church who said, came up to me a week ago and said, well, are you still an anti-Trumper? And I said, yes, more than ever. And so he sort of prompted and said, and I said, well, what about when you have the people closest to him? What about when you have Kelly, Mattis? And his response, well, they're entitled to their opinion. And I wanted to say, but they've worked with him. They know him. But it wasn't going to change anything. Once that mind was made up, it didn't matter if you'd been the closest to the president you could be and you were saying this man is unfit for office. That was just your opinion.
There was an interesting analysis in the New York Times today that he was able to take his grievances and tap and make them the people that voted their grievances, because they have grievances. And he the second time he did it in 16, was able to tap into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, because he spoke to it, and the Democrats were not speaking to it, not saying, I know you have a problem. I know things are bad at the grocery store, but we're doing everything we can to bring it down. This is how we are going to do it. Spend a little more time on how expensive tariffs are going to be. If he puts all these tariffs in, those are just sales taxes. But they just kind of threw those out at the end. And that's not, that's sort of beyond what the average, you'd have to say a tariff on Chinese goods would cost you X amount more for your next whatever piece of equipment it was, or whatever, what's the most common product that you buy. China makes everything that we buy. And they never took it down to the average person.
Governor, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Good to talk to you.
Former Republican New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman, who also served as head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency under Republican President George W. Bush.
And that's all the time we have for this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thanks so much for listening.
For more news throughout the week, listen to our podcast, The Issue, which you can download or listen to on our website or get wherever you get your podcasts.
Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.